British police come under fire for using force against people holding a vigil in London in honor of a woman kidnapped and killed by an officer. Anti-racism protesters rally in two U.S. cities to mark 1 year since African-American Breonna Taylor was shot dead by the cops. And Washington says that Pyongyang has not responded to its behind-the-scenes diplomatic maneuvers on its nuclear activity. Great pleasure to have you with us. Now, starting with our top story, London police have come under fire for restraining and arresting several people at a vigil for a woman who was kidnapped and killed by an officer. Officers scuffled with protesters after hundreds rallied despite COVID restrictions. Organizers condemned police actions, saying that officers physically manhandled women at the event, helped to call attention to dangers women are facing in London. Meantime, the Home Secretary and the London Mayor demand explanations from the police, while Liberal Democrats are calling for the Metropolitan Police Chief to resign. A London police officer has been charged with kidnapping and murdering Sarah Everard. She disappeared on March the 3rd while walking home from a friend's house. Ahmed Caballo says that the police have failed both in terms of response to the Sarah Everard vigil and their responsibility to protect young women like her.
Now, around the same time as this tragic case, there was a YouGov poll that said 97% of women, young women, have been harassed in public spaces. 80% of all women. Now, yesterday there was a vigil in South London in Clapham. I attended this vigil. It was expected to be a quiet vigil, yet the police used very heavy-handed nature to disperse the vigil, arrested several women, and this has only added to the anger on the ground. Now, the vigil was called off by the British Home Office, and people were advised to stay away. But nonetheless, the way the police reacted was completely disproportionate, particularly considering the sensitivity of this case, as the accused is a sitting Metropolitan Police officer, and many people were shouting at the police officers that were arresting women, arrest your own, i.e. sort out your own institution, which has been accused of two very grievous crimes here. Not only did a city metropolitan police officer allegedly kidnap and murder a woman while walking home, but apparently, a couple of days before that, he exposed himself in an indecent way in a McDonald's restaurant. And had he been arrested and charged for that, then Sarah Everard would still be alive today. That's why people are angry.
Now, protesters in the French city of Lyon have taken to the streets to protest the controversial security bill. The rally was organized by activists and families of victims of police brutality. Demonstrators voiced opposition to the bill and slammed it as a violation of their rights. The motion is seeking to restrict circulation of images of police violence. It would also extend police surveillance powers through the use of CCTV and drones. The bill is expected to go before Senate on March 16th. Critics say that the measures restrict civil liberties. Now, elsewhere in Europe, Germans are heading for the polls in regional elections, which are seen as a litmus test for Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservative Party. People are voting in the southwestern states of Baden-Württemberg and Rhineland-Palatinate. Recent polls show that support for Merkel's Christian Democratic Union and its Bavarian sister party, Christian Social Union, has fallen to around 30%. And that's because voters are critical of the government's handling of the COVID crisis, including a delayed start of free rapid testing. A face mask corruption scandal also forced three lawmakers to resign. Leaders of the Allied parties feared that a loss in regional elections could leave the party in opposition at national levels. Now let's take a look at the U.S. Now, Black Lives Matter activists have rallied in the city of Louisville, Kentucky, to mark 1 year since African-American Breonna Taylor was shot dead by cops. Protesters held up signs and chanted slogans including No Justice, No Peace while marching through the streets. Taylor's mother was also among the ralliers to demand justice for her daughter. A similar event was held in New York City, with protesters saying justice has yet to serve a year after Breonna's killing. They argued that equity does not exist among American citizens.
It's been a year since Breonna Taylor's death, and there's really no justice yet. Death was really unnecessary. Her life needs to be valued, and it's important to be here and remind everyone that we haven't forgotten that justice still needs to be served.
Especially as a white person, it's really important to stand up and have solidarity with the community and say, this is not right. I benefit from the privilege that I have, and I want to change that so that that kind of inequity doesn't exist. I know that if it was me in that apartment, I probably wouldn't have been shot and killed.
The 26-year-old black woman was caught in crossfire during a police raid on her apartment. The law enforcement officers who were looking for a friend obtained a controversial no-knock warrant to make a drug-related arrest. FBI saying its probe into the incident has made significant progress. Failure to bring homicide charges against the officers sparked several demonstrations in Louisville. Taylor's death is seen as one of the many cases of police violence and racism which triggered Black Lives Matter protests in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world. Well, 1 year after it started, the U.S. Coronavirus response has been infamously ineffective from a social or economic or health standpoint. From preventing deaths to preventing poverty, Corona has revealed deep socioeconomic divides, which have clearly worsened over the last terrible 12 months. From Chicago, Robin Mazahari has more.
On March 13th, then United States President Donald Trump declared the coronavirus to be a national emergency. 1 year later, many believe that the world's richest country has had the world's worst national response to the pandemic. At over a half million fatalities, the U.S. has twice as many deaths as the second hardest hit nation, Brazil. Many attribute that to the U.S. being alone among developed nations in having an almost entirely for-profit healthcare system.
It's been an extremely tough year, which is atrocious for the richest country on earth. You know, China and much of Southeast Asia have been managed to control the virus. Much poorer countries, Australia and New Zealand, which are, you know, English-speaking capitalist countries, have managed to contain the virus. So the U.S. response is, you know, from the government's really pathetic at this point.
The U.S. emulated China's example by calling for lockdowns, but they came without the governmental safety net nor the cultural solidarity which such mass quarantines seem to require. The resulting economic and personal devastation is still too enormous to be fully grasped, but the lockdowns clearly penalized the lower classes the most, caused inequality to soar, and resulted in the nation's worst economic situation since the Great Depression. The virus hit poor and non-white communities disproportionately hard, and then when the U.S. developed vaccines, these communities have been disproportionately excluded from receiving them.
A major reason for the poor U.S. response is, you know, how decentralized and dysfunctional the system is. And on the other hand, the lack of, you know, a militant, independent, working class movement to really fight and demand those things that people in other countries are getting. If we had that sort of militant, working class organization, we could have made those demands. The ruling class, the capitalists, would have probably conceded more.
The pandemic came amid, or maybe contributed to, major social protests towards racist policing, a bitterly disputed presidential election, and the hardening of unprecedented social divisions over the past year. The United States has pinned its recovery not on making structural changes, but on the vaccines that they have been able to produce. Should the vaccines fail to prevent a third major corona wave this spring, the resulting socioeconomic and cultural disaster would reach uncharted territory. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The United States says that North Korea has not responded to its behind-the-scenes diplomatic push for talks since mid-February. A senior official of the administration of President Joe Biden says that Washington has used several channels to reach out to Pyongyang, but to no avail. According to an unnamed official, there has been no active dialogue for more than a year, despite multiple U.S. attempts. Former President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un met twice in 2018 and 2019, for denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, but the engagement failed as Washington refused to relieve any sanctions in return for North's goodwill measures. The Biden administration has not publicized its approach to North Korea, but it's saying it's carrying out a policy review. Okay, now let's see what's going on in terms of denuclearization in North Korea. So joining me will be a couple of guests. Our own correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, is joining us, and also we'll have Kim Do-shu, senior fellow at the Pangol Institution out of Beijing. Good to have both of you on this show. Well, let's go to Jennifer Chang first in Beijing. Jennifer, 1 year passes, like you just heard, multiple attempts by the U.S. As they say, no response from Pyongyang. What has been happening in North Korea in terms of denuclearization, or the opposite, the other way around, in the past year?
Well, in the past year, North Korea has been doing the opposite of denuclearization. It has further done submarine ballistic missile development. And although it has not actually come and done tests with that, it has showed these submarine missiles at a parade earlier this year, which demonstrated that it has come a long way and is now ready to hit the U.S. with nuclear missiles, nuclear-tipped warheads from a submarine close to the U.S. coastline. And furthermore, it has also developed its ICBM missile engine testing facility site, which it destroyed due to its promise to President Trump at the first Singapore summit in 2018. And U.S. President Donald Trump was so happy that he actually canceled the military drills between South Korea and the U.S. here on the Korean Peninsula, which the North says are a rehearsal for an invasion. But now these are being introduced again here in Korea, and the Biden administration is supporting them. And the Biden administration is not doing anything to relieve sanctions, to cancel these military drills. In fact, it's not even going as far as President Trump did. So any kinds of behind the closed doors overtures toward North Korea are not going to get anywhere. The North wants to see action. And for the last year, the North has not seen any action, because after President Trump did that, he suddenly turned around 360 degrees the following year in 2019 at the Hanoi summit, the second summit between the two sides, and suddenly said, you give up all your nuclear bomb fuel and all your nuclear bombs and all your ballistic missiles, and then we'll give you some sanctions relief and security guarantees. Mm-hmm. So now the North is saying, look, we can't do anything with the U.S. administration always changing its mind like that. The administration is always changing like this. President Trump might even run for re-election and come back again with his, you know, maximum sanctions against North Korea. And the ball is in the U.S. court to do action, not just words.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me turn to Beijing, to Mr. Xu. So what do you think, given what was said, Jennifer Chang just explained what has been going on the past year, and looks like North Korea has been moving the wrong way in the eyes of Washington. So what is it advisable for the new administration of the White House to do if they really want to see North Korea denuclearized?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at the Western media or the remarks from Washington, it's mostly about, you know, how North Korea presents itself as a threat to the security of the U.S. or Japan or South Korea. But people also should think about, looking at the issue from North Korean point of view. Actually, the U.S. presents itself as the biggest threat to the survival of the government. We know U.S. is way more powerful in terms of military forces, in terms of the traditional forces against North Korea. If there's a threat, that's probably Washington, not North Korea. And so, you have to take that into consideration. There's a concern from Washington side, but also there's probably a bigger concern from North Korean side. And North Korea has basically followed its pledge to Washington in their negotiation with the previous administration, the Trump government over there. For example, the return to the ashes, release the hostage. They even destroyed one of their nuclear sites, reducing their nuclear capability. But what did the U.S. do? And suspicion of the military maneuver in the Korean Peninsula, they can resume that very soon, and they are doing that for the spring and the summer military exercise in the Korean Peninsula. So it's really about the lack of consistent policy from Washington that somehow has stalled this negotiation or the efforts to resolve this stalemate of the nuclear issue in the Korean Peninsula.
So this way, denuclearization will not get anywhere, right? Because North Koreans have not seen anything in return for their goodwill measures.
That's a good point. For North Korean side, ultimatum this denuclearization, as Washington has insisted, is not entirely acceptable for North Korea as long as the U.S. follow up their agreed upon rules. For example, right before the last summit between Trump and Kim in Vietnam, the U.S. senior official John Bolton, which is somebody accused him of a warmonger, talked about a Libya-style solution to North Korea issue. We know what that means. That means the killing of North Korean leader. And how is that acceptable to North Korea? Obviously, someone in that administration, tried very hard to sabotage any effort to resolve the issue over there. And then, Trump, persuaded by his own official, changed his mind and basically demanding North Korea to give up everything. And in return, the U.S. will think about what they will do to respond to that. So that's basically unfair agreement or unfair demand. That's just impossible for North Korea to agree upon.
Okay. And with that, we come to the end of this news review. Let me thank my guests. We had Jennifer Chang, our correspondent in Seoul, and also Kim Do-shu, senior fellow at the Hangul Institution, who joined us out of Beijing. Well, moving on with the rest of this broadcast, the U.S. Defense Secretary is saying that it's traveling to Asia to boost the military cooperation and also partnership with American allies. Lloyd Austin says that the U.S. and its allies want to make sure that they have the capability to, quote, offer credible deterrence to China or anybody else who would want to take on the U.S. Austin kicked off his first foreign visit as a Pentagon chief via Hawaii, the seat of the American Military Command for the Indo-Pacific region. The trip will take him to India, Japan, and South Korea, where he is to hold meetings with top officials. He'll also be joined in Tokyo and Seoul by Secretary of State Antony Blinken. The Biden administration insists a tough approach toward China can be more effective by shoring up alliances. Well, that's a wrap for this news broadcast.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
aperture.
Welcome back. We met Javot Karoui, an enthusiastic young nature explorer, and followed him as he discovered some of Iran's most unspoiled natural attractions in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. We visited the exotic Martian mountains with their peculiar shapes and ventured deep into the intertwining and spiral cave of the region. And finally, we joined Javot as he gazed into the mesmerizing waters of the Sea of Oman above the rocky cliffs. Stay with us as we further explore the wonders of the region and meet the kind-hearted locals.
The area is so beautiful and unspoiled. It is home to large flocks of birds, such as the cormorant sitting on the sandy beaches offering a scenic spectacle. It is the perfect place for bird watchers to come and feast their eyes on these exotic animals. Bird watching is a branch of tourism, or to be exact, ecotourism. Bird watchers are steadily growing in number. Cormorants are aquatic birds. They are medium to large in size, with a body weight in the range of 0.35 to 5 kilograms and a wingspan of 45 to 100 centimeters. The majority of the species have dark feathers. They are excellent divers, and underwater, they propel themselves with their feet with help from their wings. Some cormorant species have been found to dive as deep as 45 meters. Cormorants nest in colonies around the shore, on trees, islets, or cliffs. They are coastal rather than oceanic birds, and some have colonized inland waters. Indeed, the original ancestor of cormorants seems to have been a freshwater bird. In my previous trips here, I saw large flocks of these beautiful birds here in this season. But this time, there aren't so many of them. One of the reasons behind the decline in their populations is because some of the locals hunt and eat them. Although cormorants are not supposed to be eaten because they are carnivorous. According to some religious scholars, flesh-eating birds are not to be eaten. The flesh of carnivorous birds may contain many diseases that can be passed on to humans if eaten. But the locals are not aware of that. Those who hunt the cormorants do not do so because there is nothing else to eat, so they have no reason to kill and consume so many of these poor birds and do irreparable damage to the wildlife and environment in the region. The environment and wildlife are manifestations of God's beauty. How can humans, who consider themselves the greatest of creations, allow themselves to harm the manifestations of God's beauty? Human survival on the planet Earth inevitably depends on the environment and on the wildlife. Therefore, our country's officials should educate the local populations and make sure that the environment in each and every part of the country is well taken care of. This has been a very beautiful day for me. Berries is one of the most beautiful places I have visited, and I have visited many over the years. A day later, I'm on my way to a beautiful village in the heart of nature, accompanied by my good friend, Sheer Muhammad Rahul. To get to Sham-e-Kohne, that's the name of the village, we have to walk a relatively long way surrounded by beautiful natural beauties. Near the village, we run into a shepherd named Sheer Muhammad, sitting under an old leafless tree by a pond. His is the simplest of lifestyles. The Baluch mainly speak the Baluchi language, a branch of northwestern Iranian languages. Experts say the Baluch language is very similar to that of the Medes, a people of Indo-Iranian origin who inhabited the western and northwestern portion of present-day Iran. and that is a testimony to the deep roots of the Baluch tribe in Iran. Today, the Baluch people live in the southwest of Iran, the south of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Oman, India, the UAE, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Zanzibar. Borders between countries haven't been able to separate members of this ancient Iranian tribe. Although they live in different countries, the Baluch have preserved their traditions. They pay each other visits, and intertribal marriages are common. The Shahnameh and several other old books have placed the dwelling place of the Baluch people at around the north of modern-day Khorasan province. For various reasons, this peace-loving, serene tribe have had to move here, the southeast of Iran, and lived in peace since. Shir Muhammad Baluch is one of the original members of the old Sham village. But today, the village is nothing more than a collection of abandoned buildings where he can rest during sizzling hot days. This is amazing. They place one lantern and both families lived under the light of that one lantern. There isn't much left of the old Sham village, but even the ruins of it speak of the very rich culture of the kind, hospitable Baluch people. One of the structures that has stood the test of time is the beautiful mosque of Old Sham, built by the very hands of those who inhabited the village many years ago. It's gotten unbearably hot by now. I am kilometers away from the coast of the Sea of Oman in Baluchistan. But that distance is not going to keep me from a much-needed dive on the golden sand beach. The difference between the temperatures in Iran's climate zones is incredible, and to many, unbelievable. I'm in the southeasternmost part of Iran, swimming in the Sea of Oman in the middle of winter. On this same day, some of my mountaineer friends climbing up Mount Damavand tell me the temperature where they are is around minus 30 degrees. That's a difference of 60 degrees between two areas of Iran. I've done my swimming, and now I've decided to travel to the southeastern end of Iranian territory. That's the Gwadar Bay, located in the Gulf of Oman on the maritime border of Iran and Pakistan. lot of fish is caught and brought to shore here. Many large trawler launches unload their catches on smaller boats on the shore. Before they arrive in Iranian territory, the fish coming from those launches are purchased by middlemen and transported to big cities around the country. The main purpose of my trip to Guadar Bay is to see the beautiful Hara mangrove forest in this border area. Hara is a species of the Lantana genus. The seeds from the tree fall into the water, where wave action takes them to more stationary parts of the sea. The Hara seeds become fixed in the soil layers of the sea and grow. Hara trees are saltwater plants that are often submerged at high tide. They are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and a complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They are adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud. We are now exactly at the mouth of Hore Bahu. This is the zero point that separates Iran from Pakistan. We are about to enter a very beautiful river. As a matter of fact, it's a Hore or Firth. It's not a river. And it continues a long way in that direction. Hore Bahu is in fact a bay area created by water from the Sea of Oman. This is the last spot before you actually arrive in the sea itself. Before the Firth, there is the Bahu Kalat River that flows from Sarbaz Mountains to the Gulf of Oman. This is it. I can see the mountains of Pakistan vividly from here. Pakistan is located right on the other side of the Hara Forest. A lot of birds and fish live here in this Firth, which, as I said, was created by salty waters from the Sea of Oman. It's a very beautiful area. The Hara forests spanning this area are indeed unique. The Hara tree grows to heights of 6 meters and has bright green leaves and twigs. It is a species of the mangrove tree that can grow in coastal saline or brackish water. They have a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. The Hara excludes salt by having significantly impermeable roots, which are highly impregnated with suberin, acting as an ultrafiltration mechanism to exclude sodium salts from the rest of the plant. Hara trees grow in 8 protected areas in Iran and are fortunately looked after by both the authorities and people. The Hara forests in the south of Iran are a major habitat for migratory birds in the cold season, and for reptiles, fish, and varieties of bivalves. Green or hooked turtles and venomous aquatic snakes are also indigenous to the forests. Bird life includes herons, flamingos, pelicans, and angler eagles. Another important feature of these forests is the appropriate and suitable seabed conditions for the ovulation of fish in the Persian Gulf. The locals say you are very likely to run into a school of dolphins passing Guadar Bay on your way to see the Hara forests. But looks like I'm down on my luck today. There are still many villages in Baluchistan that have weathered the storm of time and preserved their traditional look. But the way to visit one of them is to seek guidance from a local guide. And that person is none other than my very own friend, Shir Muhammad. We have a long way ahead of us to the village we have decided to visit. To get there, we have to drive on a vast plain. There are no paved roads. Not so much as a dirt track. The name of the village is Nilay. Baluchistan is a very dry province. It rains very little here. As a result, not very long ago, the people of Baluchistan would dig a catchment to accumulate what little rainwater that fell from the sky. Those catchments acted as their only water reservoirs. They called them hotags. The importance of drinking water is not lost on anyone nowadays. Aware of the shortage of this vital liquid, countries around the world have embarked on preserving and conserving drinking water in recent years. The best way to prevent water from going to waste in a country like Iran that's facing a severe water problem is changing the consumption pattern. Put it simply, every human being needs only 10 liters of water to wash their whole body. But most of us keep the water running while having a shower and let something between 100 and 200 liters of precious drinking water go into the septic tank. Nowadays, most of us think that to keep our yards clean, we have to wash them with tap water every week. While in the past, although the problem of water was not as serious in Iran as it is now, and the population was not as big, people would clean their yards with sprinkles of water and a broom. And the purpose was to prevent dust from rising when sweeping. In the past, there weren't as many cars that needed to be washed with drinking water every few days. But today, millions of liters of water is consumed every year to wash the millions of vehicles across the country. I came to realize the importance of drinking water in recent years. On one of my trips to this same Baluchistan region, I ended up bathing with only 3 liters of water after going without a wash for a whole week. It was a time when the people here were grappling with a drought. That incident led me to understand the importance of drinking water in Iran. I now understand why we shouldn't let even a single drop of it go to waste. This is one of the oldest houses in this whole area. In this whole village. And Haji Khodabakhsh was in fact born in this same house. He's giving me a tour of the interior. The houses in the village of Nilag are beautiful and traditional. But there is one house in this village that is very old, very beautiful, and unique. In Baluchi language, this house is called a kud. It is dark in the house. There is no electricity, no running water, and not even a room. This is all there is to it. The owner says that all the members of the family, and there were 9 of them, used to live together in this house that is no more than one big lounge. But despite all the deprivations, the members of the family are as close as ever. The Baluch are a very kind, family-loving people. I feel an eerie feeling of calm among these pure souls. Baluch hospitality makes any stranger visiting these parts feel at home in their houses. You feel like you were born and raised in one of these houses and lived a good, simple life growing up with these genial and warm people. Most of the Baluch people who don't go fishing at sea are herders, and in this area, camels are the best livestock to keep. Camels have adapted very well to the environment and climate of Baluchistan. My journey is coming to an end. Sheer Muhammad tells me about one of his friends. Mr. Shah Bakhsh is one of the main camel herders in the region. The old camel rider tells me about Baluch kindness towards all of the world's creatures. Kindness embedded in the culture of this people. The Baluch are a very kind and passionate people, traits that are evident in the words of Mr. Shah Bakhsh. When I ask him if he has ever tried camel meat, he says the Baluch normally do not eat camel. That's because camels are loved by these people, and so they don't have the heart to slaughter them, much less eat their meat. I have arrived at the end of my trip, a trip that taught me many valuable lessons about the Baluch people and Baluchistan. This is a province with a beautiful, unspoiled environment, a place where the sea meets the mountains and plains. The Baluch people, with their rich ancient culture, are a source of great pride for Iran. I, too, am proud of these honest, kind people. Proud of having such generous fellow countrymen and women. The Sea of Oman looks like a drop of water against the unfathomable hearts of these people. All I want for the people here is proper, stable jobs compatible with their culture and environment, created by competent and caring government officials. I hope for facilities and development to come to this part of my country without doing any damage to its ancient culture and pristine environment.
Well, perhaps Iran's internationally renowned mosques and ancient remnants of Isfahan and Shiraz are what attracts most visitors from far and wide, but I'm sure many nature-loving individuals have become interested in visiting Iran's southernmost region and the pristine natural wonders of Sistan and Baluchistan. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
In the limelight.
A new book, Poisoning the Pacific, examines the U.S. military's long role in the environmental degradation of East Asia and Pacific Islands, severely impacting the health of the region's people and U.S. personnel stationed there. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by John Range, author. This article is published under the heading U.S. Military Exposed 600,000 to Toxins in Japan and Micronesia, and Hit It. Here's more. A new book, Poisoning the Pacific, examines the U.S. military's long role in the environmental degradation of East Asia and Pacific Islands, severely impacting the health of the region's people and U.S. personnel stationed there. Author John Mitchell is a Tokyo-based journalist, and much of his book focuses on Japan, especially its southernmost prefecture of Okinawa. But he also covers contamination in places like Vietnam, Guam, and the Marshall Islands. The hazards range from nuclear fallout to the chemical weapons sarin and VX to PFAS, a class of potentially carcinogenic forever chemicals, so-called because once in the body or environment, they remain for a long time. The U.S. military and supporting government agencies have long prioritized public relations over mitigating harm. When an accidental spill exposed Okinawan-based workers to lead, cadmium, and hexavalent chromium in 1975, the U.S. consulate cabled the State Department, urging the U.S. to prepare the best possible political posture in the event of future pollution accidents. Handbooks issued on Marines from 2013 to 2015 barred them from informing Japanese officials of potentially and politically sensitive incidents. while detailing the environmental catastrophes the U.S. military inflicts on these places, Mitchell also lays out its efforts to cover them up. Among its many techniques, the crudest is outright lying. In 1965, Marines training in Okinawa let CS gas, a tear gas component, drift into a nearby middle school, causing students to suffer throat pain and difficulty breathing. The Marines, however, told teachers their pupils must have inhaled gun smoke. Then there is secrecy. In 1986, Congress's General Accounting Office produced a report on hazardous waste management problems at overseas bases. Such reports are normally made public, but the Defense Department insisted that this one be classified. In Japan, intergovernmental matters involving U.S. bases are handled by the U.S.-Japan Joint Committee, which acts, Michelle writes, in total secrecy with zero public oversight. In 2000, the committee collaborated on a joint statement of environmental principles. The final product declared that the U.S. would remedy any U.S. military-caused contamination posing a known imminent and substantial threat to human health. Here was one of the subtler deceptions, as all three conditions are vague and disputable. Imminent, for example, excludes toxins that accumulate in the body over time. One of the U.S. military's hurriest cover-up methods is smearing critics as anti-American or anti-military. In 1954, a U.S. nuclear test irradiated a Japanese fishing boat. Crew members were sickened, and one died within months. Understandably, people were upset, but the U.S. ambassador to Japan called those who spoke out neutralists, pacifists, feminists, and professional anti-Americans. Ultimately, 32 million Japanese people signed a petition to ban thermonuclear weapons. There is a lot of professional anti-Americans. In 1990, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs spoke darkly of anti-military hidden agendas behind environmental policies. But the epithet anti-military might better apply to those who conceal the harm to U.S. personnel and deny them treatment. For example, in late 1970s, when the Pentagon sent service members to clean up Enid Wak Atoll, severely contaminated from U.S. nuclear tests, it failed to provide them with hazmat suits or respirators, while assuring Congress otherwise. To keep up the pretense, when journalists visited the clean-up site, soldiers were given full-body safety equipment and posed for the cameras. The only time most of the men saw such gear during their time on the island, writes Mitchell. And in 2013, when barrels containing dioxin, a contaminant produced in the manufacture of military herbicides, were unearthed on land formerly part of Kadena Air Base in Okinawa, base leadership assured service members that aside from the skin disease, chloroquine, no other human health effects have been proven. The Environmental Protection Agency begs to differ. Dioxins are highly toxic and can cause cancer, reproductive and developmental problems, damage to the immune system, and can interfere with hormones. The barrels were found under a children's soccer field, adjacent to schools attended by children of U.S. personnel. Another weapon in the military's armory is to site its bases and testing in U.S. territories and other places with limited sovereignty, enabling it to ignore the rights of the people there. After the Second World War, the United Nations granted the U.S. trusteeship of Marshall Islands. Within months, the U.S. was using the territory as a nuclear weapons test site. Several years later, seeking locations for deploying those weapons, the U.S. chose Okinawa, which it ruled by fiat until 1972. Even now, U.S.-backed conservative governments in Tokyo routinely side with the Pentagon over their own citizens in Okinawa, effectively granting it vast sway over public health. As a reporter, Mitchell has personally encountered obfuscation, having been spied on and blocked from accessing public U.S. military websites. In 2016, an American university's Tokyo campus invited him to speak about Okinawa's environmental degradation. The State Department talked the school's U.S. headquarters into ordering the Tokyo branch to schedule a separate lecture for a U.S. embassy official. In the end, however, the embassy canceled its talk, claiming staff were too busy. Via a Freedom of Information Act request, Mitchell eventually learned the real reason for the cancellation. An embassy official had warned, "This sounds like a death trap." That is, they realized that if U.S. personnel with health concerns showed up, as they had to Mitchell's talk, it would be a PR disaster. The U.S. military's pattern of deceit extends beyond the period covered in the book. On April 10, 2020, a barbecue party held by U.S. Marines in a hangar on Futenma Air Base in Okinawa triggered the release of firefighting foam. No one present knew how to turn it off, and 38,000 gallons spilled outside the base. The foam contained one of the PFAS forever chemicals and contaminated such places as children's playground. Okinawa Prefecture requested soil samples to check for contaminants, and on May 1st, officials were finally allowed on base to receive some. A week earlier, though, the Marines had excavated the same area in order to remove all possible contaminants. Thus, they provided soil samples only after ensuring they would be useless. When prefectural officials requested samples from other areas, the Marines initially refused, relenting only on May 11th, over a month after the incident, when they provided additional samples. But as usual, there were conditions. While Okinawa wished to analyze four constituents, it was allowed to analyze only two. In sum, the U.S. military has exposed 600,000 people, including Americans, to toxins in Japan and Micronesia, according to Mitchell's very conservative estimate.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.